to open the House Committee on Rural Communities, Land Use, and Water, and open a public hearing on House Bill 3147, and ask our colleague, Representative McLean, to join us and tell us about this bill.
Thank you, Chair Clem and Vice Chairs Hellman Post, distinguished members of the committee, and of course, Vic Gilliam. Mm-hmm. House Bill 3147.
That's in order.
Yes.
Oh, sorry.
House Bill 3147 is has really one purpose, and that is to try to solve what is a chronic problem, industrial land siting. And I put forth a bill in, I believe it was a short session, that came before your committee, Chair Clem, and it was to have a cap of time or speed up the time in which we could have industrial land siting in areas of chronic high unemployment. And Farm Bureau, Oregon Farm Bureau, had some questions on it, asked me to withdraw the bill. I did at their request, and I was happy to do so to try to bring something together. Because I represent the district with the highest unemployment, my largest city is 9,500 people. It's the second poorest city in Oregon. And if status quo is our sentence, then we are abandoning a generation of Oregonians. Status quo cannot be acceptable. So I don't think this is perfect, but for goodness sakes, it's something. And my hope is that there will be some robust discussion, if not some solutions that could come out of a study that says, in essence, we want places like Prineville and Lapine and other, some of these areas of chronic high unemployment, to be able to have an advantage, to be able to assure people, look, if you need a footprint, we can get to that decision quickly. That's why I put forth the bill. I hope you will agree, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Any questions for our colleague? Okay.
Thank you.
Easy. We've got two witnesses, Carrie McLaren and, or maybe three, and Rob Halliburton, and then Clark. Okay, come on up. Okay, Carrie and Rob, I've got you first.
We're happy to go first, sir.
Go ahead.
Good afternoon, Chair Clem, members of the committee. My name is Carrie McLaren. I'm the Deputy Director for the Department of Land Conservation and Development. With me to my left is Rob Halliburton. He's the manager of our Community Services Division at the department, and the division within which much of the technical assistance, planning assistance, grant funding, et cetera, to communities to do economic opportunities analysis and like planning activities occurs. So I brought him in case there were questions that I couldn't answer myself, candidly. So I think there are two different ways, I'll say at the outset, of reading the bill, and I think this is just important from our department's perspective so that we would have clarity of the charge that we were undertaking. As I read the bill, I focused on the siting and development piece of it, and carried with it, therefore, an interpretation that we're really talking about once lands have been zoned for industrial uses, how can we, what are some opportunities, some methodologies, some tools that we can use to speed up the permitting process for those lands to actually be developed. During Representative McLean's introduction, it seemed he might also be speaking to the supply of sites, and so I raise that not as a an opinion statement, but just as a clarity of purpose so that we would understand the charge of any such study. Going to the permitting processing period, I just note for this committee that the state has made some efforts to improve the timelines for getting a site ready, developed, and sort of online through Senate Bill 766, the shovel-ready sites programs, and really a lot of the charge of the Regional Solutions Centers are to try to align state agencies so that they're working together in a coordinated fashion on permitting processes for larger scale projects. Again, that does really usually impact those larger scale projects and not some of the smaller ones. Those actions, I would say, are individual actions and attempts to address the timeliness and make things happen faster for communities, and not really a study of all the different tools, methodologies, improvements that could be made to do that. And in that sense, studying those, looking for additional opportunities that may work, I think would be an appropriate endeavor. So my points are really two then, just to be clear in terms of what the focus of the study is. And if that is something that the charge is, we want to have the department study it and really just frame that issue as best fit, that's also certainly appropriate. I say this because as we look around the state at some communities that are really struggling to bring economic development to their communities, a serious impediment is the provision of infrastructure to make those sites actually be able to come online. So I say that part, again, to highlight the clarity of purpose, the context within which we would want to do this study. The second part is our experience with our recent efforts in terms of streamlining the urban growth boundary through House Bill 2254, which was passed in 2013 unanimously, actually, by the House and the Senate, to streamline urban growth boundary evaluations and expansions. The legislature, thankfully, made a significant investment in terms of data and research to guide that policy. Policy development, and we would anticipate having a fiscal on this so that we could really do quality work and bring to this body a quality and thorough answer. I would close, be happy to answer any questions that the committee may have, but don't have really anything more to add at this time.
Let's do all of our witnesses first, and then we'll do questions.
I'm just here to answer questions.
Okay.
Thank you.
And Claire?
Yes. Chair Klum and members of the committee, I'm Claire Clock from Corbett, Oregon, a farmer and resource conservationist educator for the past 40 years. It's hard to express both my gratitude and dismay at the land use planning system in Oregon. I was 22 years old when Senate Bill 100-101 was enacted with a promise of protecting farm and forest land by creating urban growth boundaries. Here we are 30 years later speaking of legislation to expedite siting and development of industrial land. I understand the need for industrial growth, and I support this bill. If this bill passes, I realize that I'll have input with the Land Conservation Development Department and how during the process that's carried out. In the matter of industrial use, I'd like just to add something, is that there's no reason that the land needs to be completely flat. If a two-story warehouse can be sited on rolling hillsides, if a truck can climb the Cascades and the Siskiyous, then it can climb the gentler slopes, such as the foothills of the Cascades or the foothills in the eastern Oregon and some of those places where we really need those jobs to reach a second level of the building. In the meantime, I really implore the legislators on a whole to seek ways to corral the destruction of working farm and forest land by land divisions and incompatible uses. Hard barriers such as creek canyons, major highways to divide forest from farm and urban sprawls. Go up and down but not out. And I've seen case after case examples of farms that run into really hard problems when you site a subdivision up against major farmland. Thank you for your attention.
Any questions for Representative McClain?
Thank you to the panel for testifying. It sounds like perhaps, Deputy Director, you and I could visit about why might be the right wording based upon your existing efforts. And certainly, if this is not needed because my goal is being met by some of your current programs, no one will be more delighted than I.
Thank you, Chair Clem, Representative McLean. I'd be delighted to meet with you to talk a little bit both about to make sure that we're understanding a charge and then to really talk about the timing of some of our UGB streamlining and see how that fits within the context. Communities are struggling. We want to assure that there are quality industrial lands and available development opportunities. Our farm and forest lands are part of the economic base in many of our rural communities, so we wear both hats, we share both challenges. But I think that you're rarely going to find our department saying looking at the problem harder, trying to find solutions isn't warranted.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Okay.
And thank I should you. Just say, actually, clarification. Hopefully you're never going to find our department not say yes to that kind of inquiry.
Thank you.
Okay. I will close the public hearing on House Bill 3147. And we don't have Peggy, did you need something?
Well, I was hoping to be able to talk on this one. I didn't get signed up. I apologize.
Come on up. Let me reopen the public hearing on House Bill 3147.
I apologize, and I'd like my name on 3169 too, please. Really quickly, Peggy Lynch, League of Women Voters of Oregon. So I follow the budgets of the Natural Resource Agency, so I just wanted to put on the record that although I understand the issue that Representative McLean is bringing up, as you may have heard, it really tends to be not lands but infrastructure and trained workforce. So as you're looking to fund education, particularly workforce training, that's really important in this legislature, and it may actually help local communities, particularly rural communities, get better jobs, find more businesses interested in locating in rural communities. The other thing is that you have House Bill 2633 that you have been discussing regarding natural hazards. If, in fact, a bill comes forward amended about that issue, it will cost money to fund. And again, I'm balancing competing interests here. The last thing is, what's really important in our small local, our small communities, particularly in our rural communities, is that their comprehensive plans and development codes get updated. So the local government grants that DLCD offers needs to be increased so that those local governments can do the planning work themselves to begin the efforts that Representative McLean is looking towards. And with that, I'd be happy to answer any questions. Thank you for allowing me to testify.
Any questions for Peggy? Okay. Let me close the public hearing on House Bill 3147. And I will open a public hearing. I'm just waiting for our colleagues on other bills, so I'll do mine now. I'll open a public hearing on House Bill 3212. Actually, I think this is listed as a committee bill, but I'll just stay up here and describe it. Colleagues, in 2007, the legislature referred to the ballot measure 49. It was a reaction to ballot measure 37. Both ballot measures 37 and 49 contained language that had to do not about land use and where you could build home sites, but about farming and forestry practices. And they both said, in essence, that the state cannot restrict a farm or forestry practice without offering compensation or a waiver to a party who's been restricted, and the ballot measure passed. In 2009, the forest products industry, along with actually, I think, 1,000 Friends of Oregon and others, came and said, you know, we didn't actually get the language probably quite right, and I think the vote was unanimous, but it was, if not, it was 59-0 or one absent, something like that. There was a bill to change the forestry language to make it clear that if there was a restriction on forestry practices, and the term is any other law enacted or rule adopted solely for the purpose of regulating a forest practice, that it would be eligible for Measure 49 compensation if the person had forestry property and then a practice was restricted. Now, there are exemptions in there for public health that if the law is passed to protect public health, you're not eligible for compensation, but if it's for any other reason, you are. And that passed in 2009. Last session, I inquired with legislative counsel about the farming language, and they said they thought it was broken and wouldn't be usable. And it's a sort of an obscure technical issue, but the way you read a statute is you assume that the statute has passed when you're reading the bill and is now law. So, for example, if we passed a law that made the growing of opium, if we passed a law that said we're going to restrict the growing of opium, and it was illegal, I've got this backwards now. Let me use a different example. So if you pass a law saying you cannot grow canola, okay? Canola is, at the time of the writing of the bill, a legal practice. After the bill is passed, it's an illegal practice. You read statutes at the time the bill has already passed. So if you were trying to, in a provision to compensate somebody who had been growing canola and all of a sudden couldn't, elsewhere in the statute it says that it had to be a legal practice that was now being made illegal. The way you read the statute is after it's already been made illegal, you then read the statute. So none of the things that people could have claimed compensation for would be eligible because they were made illegal. And my opium example would be if we were trying to regulate opium sales, that was already illegal, so that would be allowed because it had been illegal before and it's illegal afterwards. But if we tried to regulate canola, for example, you would not be able to under the way the law was written. So this is a technical adjustment to that. And the way it works, it says in line D, it says, any law enacted or rule adopted solely to restrict a farming practice that was allowed immediately prior to the enactment of the law or adoption of the rule. If this is a little bit confusing, but LC assured me that if you wanted to ever make Measure 49 work for farmers, you need to put the line in that says that was allowed immediately prior to enactment of the law, because otherwise everything is illegal by the time you're reading this provision. The other part that's different is the language here is meant to match the forestry practices. Before, it talked about agricultural rules around water quality and some other agricultural rules, but it wasn't as broad as the forestry. This will make it mirror the forestry statute. So basically, you would be able to file a Measure 49 claim if you're a farmer who has had a unit of government restrict your practices, you'd be able to file a claim for waiver or compensation if the point of the regulation was to restrict your farming practice and wasn't to protect public health, but to protect other things like market access or market purity. You could file for a Measure 49 waiver or compensation. And this matches what we did in 2009 for forestry. I believe, having sat on the committee that wrote Measure 49, it honors the intent of what Measure 49 was. I've had a little bit of conversation with the governor's office where there may be some work that needs to be done around marijuana, for example, before we could do something with this bill. But otherwise, I would encourage your support of it once we get to that point. And I have Jim Johnson from the Department of Agriculture here to testify. I'd be happy to take any questions, or we could let Jim testify and then talk about it further if you have questions. Jim, why don't you come up?
Mr. Chair, one question.
The plan.
Who told, I didn't hear, who told you that they opined that the farm aspect of the Measure 49 implementation statute was not workable?
Legislative counsel. It was Harrison Conley at the time.
Okay.
And I was inquiring, I think, about, I don't remember what I was inquiring about, but I said, wouldn't these be eligible for Measure 49? He said, no, that statute doesn't work at all. I thought you guys did that on purpose. And I said, no, it was not on purpose. What do you mean?
No.
And he described this thing about when you're reading the statute, if the act that you're trying to regulate is illegal, you are not required to compensate someone for not doing an illegal activity. Mm-hmm. But he said everything that you will have passed is therefore illegal at the time at which we're reading the statute. So anything you tried to do to use Measure 49 would be illegal. And you would be basically ineligible to use Measure 49 at all because it's already illegal. You made it illegal 1 second ago, and now we're reading the statute, and it's illegal. So therefore, Measure 49 is completely useless to any farmer who would want to use it.
Okay, and so the goal of this bill would be to correct that, or at least make it clear that no, this does need to be implemented based upon the assumption that predating lawful activities other than
correct.
Public health
right.
are deemed legitimate for the purposes of Measure 49 application.
Correct.
Okay,
yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah, much better way of explaining it than I did. Jim.
Chair Clem, committee members, my name is Jim Johnson. I'm the land use specialist for the Oregon Department of Agriculture. The department would like to express some concerns or questions we have regarding this bill, but first, a couple of points. The two elements of this bill that, you know, that we're most focused on, and basically the two elements of the bill, is the what Representative Clem just talked about in terms of the definition of land use regulation would be amended to talk about restricting a farming practice. And I think it's really important right there to recognize that the term that's used is farming practice, so it's not crop specific. So canola may be legal, but we wanted to discuss one element of that, a practice related to that. That's different than, you know, crop versus farming practice, and that's what the term is here. It's farming practice. It's not about all agriculture. So that's an issue right up front for us. If we wanted to do something related to just a practice associated with growing a crop, that could be a concern. And then second, the other part that the bill does is it actually deletes from the exemptions a reference to right to farm, and I'll talk a little bit more about that later, but that's also an issue with us.
You're right. I should have actually pointed people to the Dash 1 amendments. That's what I was testifying to. That removes the deletion of the reference to right to farm. I'm not sure why that even got done, to be honest, but that was an accident in drafting. I also, on the Dash 1s, used the term... I use the exact term from the forestry statute. Right now in the bill it says solely to restrict a farming practice, and the forestry statute says solely for the purpose of regulating a forestry practice. So the Dash 1s make it mirror exactly. I'm not sure that solves your first issue about practice versus crops and things like that, but the right to farm thing we did catch, and that was inadvertent. I'm not sure why.
The other thing I'd like to point out before I get into some specific responsibilities that ODA has that we're concerned about with this bill is that I'm comparing regulation of forest practices with regulation of agricultural practices is a big stretch. Take this, not personal forest industry, whatever, but they're a monoculture. They basically have one crop that we're talking about, so there's a very narrow associated window of types of practices. When you look at agriculture, we've got over 250 commodities grown in this state with a myriad of agricultural practices for each commodity. And so it's much harder to just blanket say we're not going to allow for regulation of agricultural practices without having some consequences. And that brings us to our questions or concerns. ODA has responsibilities in terms of some people would call regulating agriculture, such in a lot of areas that we think could be implicated by this, and that's our question or comment or concern. And I'll just give you a couple of examples, and this is not an exclusive list. Confined animal feeding operations, if we wanted to amend our rules, what would that do to address that? Shellfish operations on state-owned tidelands, we regulate that, and what if we wanted to amend things there? Vermiculture, we actually in the statute have the ability to regulate vermiculture, worms and worm castings and the like. Growing a farm of biopharmaceutical crops, we have statutes that talk about us regulating that. Pesticides regulations beyond federal law. We do that currently. We have some rules on the book, and we do amend those off and on that actually go beyond federal law. We have the ability to do that under the law and the statute, and we wonder if that would be problematic. And I'll give you an example that's been in the news a lot lately. We've went beyond federal regulations to protect bees and the linden trees, the pesticides that deal with that, and the linden trees in the Target parking lot in Wilsonville. That regulation that we adopted there goes beyond federal law. So would that be implicated by this statute is a question we have. Other concerns that I'd just like to point out as a land use specialist, what would this bill do in terms of limiting the ability of local governments to use livestock control districts, open range versus closed range? That's implemented at the local level. What would this do in terms of local governments regulating or precluding agriculture in non-ag zones, like residential zones? Rural residential zones, industrial zones, and like there are many jurisdictions that do that currently. Representative Clem mentioned Measure 91, but we're getting more and more questions about the ability or what can do in terms of regulations related to the growing of marijuana. And lastly, and it's been addressed, but what would be the implications to right to farm, because it's currently exempt? We're a little bit concerned there about what's being called more and more reverse regulation, where somebody would say right to farm takes away their ability to file a nuisance or trespass, thus it's changing the value of their land because they can't sue a farmer for trespass or nuisance, and thus their land is decreased in value. And we're concerned about what that exemption would do there. It sounds like that's being removed, but that's one of our issues. So really, we have some concerns and questions. We are neutral on the bill at this stage right now, but we wanted to get these forward for your consideration. Thank you.
So let's walk through like the linden tree deal, because that's a good example. So the way it would work, the Department of Ag would pass a rule saying you can't spray linden trees during this time of year, or you can't spray it with this chemical. And then the way Measure 49 works, the person doing the quote-unquote farming practice, which in this case would be the sprayer, would have to show an appraisal that your regulation cost their land value. Like that tree would have to show up as an appraised loss in value. This one would not obviously be to protect human health, it would be to protect bee health, so they couldn't apply for, you know, you couldn't say, well, this is a human health issue, so you're exempt from Measure 49 claims, but you would have to show an appraisal that they lost value on not being able to spray their linden tree with that particular, you know, neonicotinoid. So I'm not sure how that would really be a problem.
Well, Chair Clem, let's say that this a situation like that came up and it was involving orchards, and there was a pest there that we wanted to regulate beyond federal law or the like. There you would have an economic value that could be lost to a farmer, for example.
So if I had a otherwise legal pesticide and the state restricted it for, not for human health purposes, but for bee health. I'm just trying to think of a practical example. Bee health purposes. I would need to demonstrate that the restriction, I would apply for waiver or compensation and try and demonstrate that the restriction costs my land value. And you're concerned that I might prevail, and then I wouldn't have to follow the regulation because I prevailed, and then we would lose a bunch of bees according to the utilization that I was using that otherwise I would not be able to because it would be illegal.
Chair Clem, possibly that, or we'd have to compensate, and that's as much a concern also.
Yeah, waiver or compensation are the mechanisms. And you don't think some of these things applied in forestry when we passed it, or you just wasn't your business because it's not your department, so you didn't pay attention?
Chair Clem, that's partially my response, but my point is it's much easier to talk about the implications to forestry because they really have a narrower set of regulations they're talking about, because you're really talking about one crop. We're talking about a lot of crops when you talk about agriculture, and each one has different practices associated with each of that. And so we're really talking about a wide range of regulations that the Department of Agriculture is involved with, from control districts to quarantines to embargoes to pesticides to water quality to shellfish, and the list goes on.
Yeah, so let's take shellfish, for example. What would be an example of a practice that might get regulated?
Chair Clem, currently, for example, when we authorize a shellfish operation in an estuary, and I'm going to pick Neatarts Bay because that's where we have most of the new ones going on or whatever, we will basically say you cannot mechanically harvest those shellfish. In other words, you can't go out there and dredge it or anything like that. It's got to be hand cultivated because of damage to eelgrass, for example. There's many types of regulations that we look at when we approve shellfish operations related to everything from navigation, protecting navigation, to protecting fisheries habitat, to a whole list of other things.
Yeah, navigation would come under public health probably, but the protection of the species because of over-harvesting, for example, would be maybe not covered.
Chair Clem, yeah, and we wouldn't, you know, we're talking about cultivation here, so it's not a native species. It's more the impact to the other species from the actual aquaculture operation.
Interesting. So your point being there may be some cases where the regulation isn't going to be covered under the exemption, may cost value, but it may be desirable to still regulate it.
Chair Clem, that's correct.
And in the case of legislature, we can notwithstand Measure 49 when we're passing a regulation, you can't, and a city or county can't.
Chair Clem, that's correct.
Yeah. Well, that's helpful information. I'm not 100% sure that I am as worried about it as you are, but I hear what you're saying, and we can continue to talk about it. Other questions for Jim, or myself, for that matter? Okay. Anybody else here on this one? Okay. I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 3212. Thanks. And Representative Wilson's here. So we will open a public hearing on House Bill 3274. Welcome our colleague.
Well, good afternoon, and great to be before your committee today, and I would like to thank you for hearing this bill. Chair Clem and members of the committee, for the record, Carl Wilson, House District 3, Grants Pass State Representative. House Bill 3274, at least I think, is a simple little bill, but of course we hear that all the time. But let me expand just a little on that. I think that most of you know the situation that my county and many other counties like mine are in, and that is that we've really never recovered since losing our resource-based economy. We have been blessed with tourism when the economy is good, but when the economy is not good, we don't get much from tourism. We're really looking for everything we can to enjoy growth in our local economy. We have a very high poverty rate. Approximately 25% of the county population, speaking of Josephine, is on food stamps. Our true unemployment rate is really more like 20% when you include the people who've just dropped out and given up. Median income for the family is in the low 30s. So as you can see, we have a really difficult situation. So we're looking for hope. We're looking just about any place we can find it. And we know that technology is always changing. And so as you can see what this bill asks, it asks that the Oregon Business Development Department shall conduct a study and submit a report to the interim legislative committees on economic development regarding methods to expand technology infrastructure in rural cities and counties here in the state. There's some really nice things on the department's website, including the Oregon Broadband Advisory Council report, which is really a comprehensive report that talks about a lot of great things, including community broadband strategic planning. But we know that infrastructure involves more than just that. This is a great report. It's still relatively fresh, but given the fact that infrastructure is changing all the time and technology changes, we hereby just make this request to see that if during the interim we can get the latest information on information technology, what is going on, and how it might be a benefit to rural Oregon. So, in essence, that is what the objective of the bill is. I hope it comes across that way. And so we would just really appreciate your consideration of it.
Any questions for our colleague? We might think about including, it's not just broadband I know that you're thinking about, but we might think about the broadband. I'm on it, and I can't remember what the A stands for. OBAC, Oregon Broadband Advisory Commission. We might think about having them participate as well as business development, because they know a lot about it. They've done gaps in where broadband access is missing and surveys around the state, that kind of thing.
Yes, Chair Clem, the report here is a great report, a tremendous amount to learn from it. And, of course, like I say, as quickly as things change anymore, we'd just like to get an updated report during the interim if we could.
Great. Any other questions? And I have nobody to testify on this one besides the representative. So, okay, you're off easy.
Chair Clement, committee, thank you very much for hearing.
And I will close the public hearing on House Bill 3274. And let me open a public hearing on House Bill. Oh, Bence is not here yet. So let's do our work sessions while we wait. We're going to have like half an hour before he's ready. Why don't you let them know we're going to be done far earlier, and we'll do our work sessions. Let me open a work session on House Bill 3030. This is our sand control districts. Representative Gomberg, what can you tell us? Are we ready to go here?
Let's get this thing going and move some sand, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. So, Mr. Vice Chair, you got anything over there?
I believe I was missing.
We don't have to do a motion first. We're just in a work session, so questions.
I just had one
Vice Chair
question,
McClain.
And I'm not even sure who
the Vice Chair Post.
Well, I'm not even sure who the question. I wrote it down after our last hearing on this, so you have to bear with me. I don't remember what I was thinking at the time. I've had
medication
quite a week. Last week, my brain is mush. Page 1, line 17 of the bill says, raise revenue by levying, assessing, and collecting taxes on taxable real property within the district under ordinances adopted, amended, or repealed under ORS 198.510 to 198.600. I wrote this question to myself, so I don't know, maybe Representative Gomberg, I could ask you, do the people of these areas want this? This is as simple a question as I could come up with.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, I have two answers to that. The first answer is yes, they want it. And second of all, if I'm not mistaken, it needs their approval in order to create these special districts.
Okay. I think that was the question that I was coming from looking at the broad picture. So I just want to make sure I got that in. But thank you very much. Okay. I'm satisfied.
Okay. Representative Gilliam.
Did we talk about the fiscal? I can't remember. It's $10 million, right?
I don't think so.
No, there's no fiscal. On this one?
No. Sand control districts? I think it just authorizes them to be created, and then they would come up with their own money and tax themselves if they ever come into existence.
Mm-hmm. No impact. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I misread something.
Oh, okay.
Chair Clem, I move House Bill 3030 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Vice Chair Post moves House Bill 3030 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Seeing none, the clerk, please call the roll.
Representative Gilliam.
Aye.
Representative Gomberg.
Aye.
Representative McClain.
Excuse.
Representative Witt.
Aye.
Vice Chair Helm.
Aye.
Vice Chair Post.
Aye.
Chair Clem.
Aye. Motion passes. The bill sent to the floor. Would you like to carry this bill, Representative Gomberg?
Please.
So noted. And then let me open up the...
Mr. Chair, with my detail on that, maybe I should carry it.
I think that's highly
advisable.
Because
I'm prepared if... No.
Like a co-carrier?
No.
There's a lot of sand in Silverton, is there?
His version's more expensive than mine, so...
Yeah. You could be a hero. You could tell your taxpayers that the state's agreed to fund the district and all of its work to the tune of $10 million, and they don't have to pay for it.
I think only the Christmas Tree District made that offer, Mr. Chairman.
That's true.
But that's where we're taking our sand to.
Oh, boy. Let me open a work session on House Bill 2734. And... Okay, why don't we have somebody come and tell us about this? Yeah, I wasn't here, and I think I went back and listened to it.
Good afternoon, Chair Clem, other members of the committee. For the record, Chris Fick with Multnomah County today, representing the Oregon Brownfields Coalition. 4 weeks ago today, you all held a hearing on this bill, House Bill 2734, and heard about the two components, the two tools that we're seeking when it comes to brownfield remediation, local land bank authority and a local property tax abatement. The Dash 1 amendments that are before you reflect that hearing and the testimony that was given. Legislative Council has done a very good job working to thoroughly embody those amendments and the will of this diverse coalition. We are here to answer any questions that you have regarding the amendments and ask for a due pass recommendation and a subsequent referral to the Transportation and Economic Development Committee, with the understanding that there will be likely some additional minor amendments that will be need to be made in that committee. But due to the timeline right now in session, we are seeking to move it there so we can start to brief those legislators and make those additional changes.
Any questions for these gentlemen? Vice Chair Post.
Well, I think, you know what? I think the amendment, again, must have been the same day or something, but I have a note to myself. There will be amendments coming to this bill, so I guess the Dash 1 covers, is all of my questions related to that, and looks like they're covered, so thank you.
And this bill goes next to Transportation Economic Development if we allow it. So we'll have another chance if something else pops up before Representative Gilliam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Once again, back to fiscal impact. It says further analysis required. Do we have a ballpark or any kind of an estimate?
We do not have anything. I'm guessing because the fiscal impacts only apply to the statements that we get, only apply to the state, and this is authorizing cities or counties. We wouldn't see fiscal impacts no matter what on the state side, but the cities and counties themselves may have something. And I think we ask them if they know what their city, what their impacts are, but I don't know that it shows up in our fiscal statements. But I do think LFO asks cities and counties and others for a fiscal impact.
Chair Clem, Representative Gilliam, if I may, both programs are permissive. They're not required, so they're at the discretion of the local authority. AOC and LOC are both supportive, but because of that, I don't believe there would be a fiscal, at least on the local government side, nor on the state side, given the nature of the bill.
Apparently, because we're not the final committee before it would go, they don't issue the full potential fiscal here.
Thank you.
Although I think the answer is going to be there wouldn't be one for the state. It would just go to...
It's not a mandate.
Yeah. And it wouldn't be a cost borne by the state. Anyway, it'd be a cost borne by the local government, and we don't usually factor, much to their chagrin, we don't factor their fiscal impact probably in the same way that we do our own. I think we may note it in some way, but I don't know that we don't send it to Ways and Means anyway, just because there's a fiscal impact on local government. Okay, any further questions? Great, thank you. And how about amendment?
Mr. Chair, I move to adopt the Dash 1 amendments.
Vice Chair Helm moves the Dash 1 amendments to House Bill 2734. Is there any discussion? Any objection? Seeing none, the amendments are adopted.
Mr. Chair, I move HB 2734 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation and that the bill be referred to the Committee on Transportation and Economic Development by prior reference.
Vice Chair Helm moves House Bill 2734 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation and that the bill be referred to the Committee on Transportation and Economic Development by prior reference. Any discussion? Seeing none, will the clerk please call the roll?
Representative Gilliam.
Aye.
Representative Gompert.
Aye.
Representative McLean.
Aye. Excused.
Representative Witt.
Aye.
Vice Chair Helm.
Aye.
Vice Chair Post?
Aye.
Chair
Clem? Aye. Motion passes and the bill sent to the TED Committee. Let me open a public hearing on House
Thank
Bill
you.
3169 and ask our colleague, Representative Benz, who's here, to tell us all about this exciting bill. And we've got some friends. Thank you for coming. We knew you had something else going, but we ran out of things to do except for this, so we weren't sure how to handle that.
It's fine. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And for the record, Cliff Benz, District 60. So House Bill 3169 is a result of an ongoing drought across the state. And the issue has to do with groundwater. And of course, as more and more people turn to wells, there's greater pressure upon the resource, and folks find their house wells going dry. And when that happens, they have to deepen those wells. And some people can't afford to do that, so this bill, in part, is brought to establish a fund, if there's money available for that, for low-income folks to have money available to deepen wells. That's most of the writing as part of the bill. The much more interesting part of the bill is in Section 1. And so Tom Paul from the Water Resources Department joins me today to go over the current situation across Oregon when it comes to groundwater. When I was on the Water Resource Commission many years ago, we realized that the lack of information concerning the nature, extent, and sustainable use of our aquifers would at some point catch up. We may well be there now. We can have Mr. Paul tell us, but part of the problem we have, Mr. Chair, is that we talk a lot about stored water and the need to build new reservoirs, and I agree wholeheartedly with the need to build new storage facilities in light of our lack of water. But we have a lot of stored water. It's just under the ground. The question is how much, where, and how can one sustainably use it? And we don't have those answers for most of the state. So what we really have, Mr. Chair, is a lot of stored water, but we don't really know how much or how well to use it. What ends up happening, of course, is in times of drought, more people drill wells. Emergency wells can be drilled under our statutes. And then the groundwater resource, about which we know little, is exhausted. And the way we find out that there isn't enough is when we get calls from people saying, my well just went dry, shut off the person that just put in a new pivot or a new well or a new this or a new that. A very unfortunate means of managing the resource. So the purpose of the bill is to ask for the department to do a study of the size, extent, and capacity and physical qualities of our aquifers. The bill is highly optimistic in that it suggests that the results of the study be submitted this November. That is absolutely hopelessly impossible. We don't have enough money, and B, that's hardly enough time to do any sort of a study. What I thought this bill would serve a couple of purposes. One, to raise the challenge that we face. It's only going to go worse, as I think most of you know. My part of the state was declared a drought emergency just a couple of days ago, already in the early days of March, which is just the third or fourth year. Our systems are in desperate straits, and this will just put even greater pressure on the groundwater resource. So with that, Mr. Chair, turn the time over to Mr. Tom Paul.
Thank you, Representative Benz, Chair Clem, members of the committee. For the record, Tom Paul, Deputy Director, Oregon Water Resources Department. Now, if I get the buttons right, we'll... look at that. I'll start out with the semi-good news. As of yesterday, March 16th, you can see that we are near normal. None of the state of Oregon has normal or above. The green represents about 90% of normal precipitation. The yellow is in the 80s. So even rainfall, we're below. Going to the next slide, this is our natural storage. This represents snowpack, and you can see all of the state of Oregon is below 50% of our natural storage. And the impact there is really midsummer on any areas that rely on snow to meet the need. Representative Benz's area is one of those that relies heavily on that release of snowpack, release of that natural storage to meet summertime and late summer demands. The Willamette, look at the numbers there, below 10% generally. The Hood, which drains off of the Cascades, 7% in the Willamette, and again, draining off the Cascades, and then down in Klamath, and you folks have heard a lot about Klamath, 6%, and again, that's draining off the Cascades. So when we get late summer, what that means is we're going to end up with more and more pressure on other sources, such as groundwater, as Representative Bentz indicated. Water rights for supplemental irrigation from groundwater that in normal years they aren't pressed very hard. We're going to see more and more pumping, more and more demand off those groundwater. This is a map that shows information from almost 2,000 wells across the state of Oregon where we have been collecting data. Red indicates that oil measurements that we have taken, we're seeing declines in excess of 100 feet in water level. And that's not just the annual pumping variation, this is long-term decline. So from 1 year to the next, the surface of that groundwater has declined by that amount. In Representative Bentz's area, you can see we're starting to get an indication of decline, where the yellow dots are showing in the neighborhood of 10 to 20 feet of decline, white dots up to 10 feet. You don't see any dots there that are showing an increase. The blues, for example, where you're seeing a higher water level, these are all declines. This slide indicates areas that we have seen interference well to well, especially up in the Umatilla Basin. You see the reds, those are critical groundwater areas, and we have seen a lot of decline. If you think back to the last map, you saw a lot of red indications up there. Water levels went down 100 feet up to 500 feet. Senior water right holders were impacted by that. Their wells actually dried up to where they could not get the water out to satisfy their senior water right. It took some time before we could get to the point of regulating, because we had to have the science we had before we could move forward. In a few instances, by the time we were able to move forward and regulate, some of the senior water right holders actually lost their property because they had to have the water to produce crops to enable them to make the loan payments and what have you. As we get as potential irrigators, water users that are looking for groundwater to meet their need, they file an application with us. We review the application, and as most of you are aware, it takes thousands of dollars, tens of thousands of dollars, to drill a well and put in a system. Huge investment. Even for a domestic well, you're looking at maybe upwards $10,000 to $20,000 just for a domestic well by the time you drill it, install the pump, and so on. With a larger well, such as for irrigation or industrial, municipal, you can be investing hundreds of thousands of dollars to drill a well, the size, and to produce the quantity of water that is needed. Once we issue that permit, development starts. We look to the permittee to accomplish certain activities and actually put that water to beneficial use within 5 years. If we get into a situation where after we issue them a permit, we see the declines, we see interference with senior water right holders, then we have to go out and regulate, they would have no way then to recover the hundreds of thousands of dollars invested, and that's also a concern.
Can I ask a question before he moves off this map?
Yeah, can you just hold on one sec, Vice Chair Post?
Thank you, Chair Clem. Just while you're still on this map, just to help me understand, you may have just explained it, but I want to make sure I understand. Classified critical withdrawn, what does that mean again exactly? That's at the permits?
Chair Clem, Representative Post, these are different administrative processes that we have to regulate or control groundwater. Some are done by administrative rule, and some at the time they were adopted were done by order. But they are varying degrees. For example, the critical groundwater areas up in the Umatilla Basin, we can actually go in and regulate off existing water rights based on data priority. With the other areas, those limitations are give us direction when we receive a water right application as to whether or not we can accept the application and process a new one. And to the point of issuing a permit, it does not give us the authority to actually regulate off existing water rights. Critical groundwater area designation is the only way that we can accomplish that kind of regulation.
Okay, so what does withdrawn mean? I mean, as I'm looking at this map, I'm trying to understand it.
Sure.
Maybe pick a couple of those and give me an example, I guess.
Representative, the Fort Rock area, for example, has been withdrawn, so we do not accept and process new applications for the use of groundwater in that area. In the Willamette Valley, the yellow areas there are included in our Willamette Basin program, and it's a classification to limit new development. And with those limitations, it again gives direction not only to the applicant but to the department as to what uses are allowed and how we process water right applications where those requests come in. The reddish areas are critical groundwater areas.
Okay, great. Thank you. Appreciate that.
This slide shows areas of the state where we have done cooperative groundwater studies. We do have a lot of information across the state, the information as to the geology and water levels, as you saw in a previous slide. This past year, for example, we collected 2,500 water level measurements from various wells across the state. In the green areas you see on the map, we have collected, really done an intense study. All three of these areas, I'll call them a formal study. It was a cooperative effort between Water Resources Department and the U.S. Geological Survey. When we get into a groundwater study of this nature, we really try to look at the entire basin and get a very, very good understanding of the geology, the water resource, trying to quantify how much water is available, what a sustainable rate of withdrawal would be, again, to protect those senior water right holders. The groundwater studies that you see here, the cost is going to run anywhere from $3 to $5 million, and that would be the state's cost. We have a match figure with the federal government, with U.S. Geological Survey, where we partner together to conduct these studies. With our department, it would involve generally 3 to 5 staff doing the work, collecting data, analyzing the data, and moving forward. Where we have had some concerns raised by other water right holders outside of these areas, we have looked, but it's been more of a, I'll say, an isolated area where we've collected a lot of data, but we have not taken a step to do a formal groundwater study like these three areas.
So, Mr. Chair, if I might.
Representative Gillian.
Thank you. Mr. Paul, thank you for being here. So, these studies have been done. Would this bill focus on those areas
outside of these three, or would there be a combination of further study, or is the bill that specific?
Thank you, Chair Clem, Representative Gillum. My understanding would be that the bill would address those areas that have not already been studied. Historically, this body has funded the Water Resources Department to conduct groundwater studies, one level or another. In 95-97, for example, our budget contained $1.2 million for groundwater studies. Then we ran into some pretty lean budget years. We were authorized for spending in the 09-11 time period, $75,000, which, you know, when a cost of a groundwater study is $3 to $5 million, 75 doesn't get us very far. But with the budget challenges that we had, those funds were removed from our budget. Same thing happened in 11-13. We do now have money in our budget in 13-15, about $375,000, and we are looking at that figure again for this biennium. So we are working to collect information. Those numbers are not sufficient to enter into a major groundwater study with USGS, but it does allow us to have the scientists necessary to go out and look on a smaller basis as we see either comments by senior water right holders or as we collect groundwater information that shows decline. Representative Bentz indicated the impact on domestic wells. Generally speaking, domestic wells are not drilled as deep as a production well, such as for irrigation, industrial, or municipal. With those larger uses, there's really a need to try to develop the resource so that it provides a reliable supply for these other larger uses. With domestics, quite often the depth drilled is driven by the amount of money that the landowner has to be able to invest in a well, and a lot of times they're looking for just enough to satisfy their drinking water needs in their house. So once they get to that point, they stop drilling. What we are finding, and it's true with continued development of the water right permits that we've already issued, or as we get into a drought situation and we issue drought permits, that's more of a demand on the system, and we're seeing water level decline such that the domestic well owners are running out of water in the summertime. This gives you a very, very coarse number as to the number of deepenings or even replacement wells that are drilled on average. And it runs around 300 wells a year across the state of Oregon. And these are domestics. It's not the industrial commercial irrigation. These are domestic wells that somebody found themselves with an insufficient quantity of water in their domestic well to meet their home needs.
Do you think the number went down because of the economy in those periods where it went down? It's not like we found more water, I don't think, or maybe we did, but it's strange. I mean, you got 600 a year, 550, 650, 600, 500, and then down to 300.
And Chair Clem, again, this is a coarse number because we do not have a good way to track which wells went dry and had to be replaced. A lot of those would show up as just a new well, not knowing whether it's their first well or a second well.
Representative Gillum, did you have something?
No, that was my question, why it went down, and we partially answered it. Obviously, snowpack wasn't that much better in that period, mm-hmm. or
other factors, right?
And Chair Clem, Representative Gillum, part of it too could be less development out in the rural area with the economy that went down. So we're seeing fewer wells constructed. In 05, earlier time period, we were seeing average annual well construction numbers of about 6,000 wells per year. And today we're down in the 3,000 to 5,000 wells per year. So we're seeing fewer.
Mr. Chair, I may, Tom, if you could go back to the that one right there. The first part of the bill is designed to address the type of issues that you see that are going to be coming up as the areas in orange become more and more water challenged, because that's where the wells are going to go dry. So it's not enough that we've done the study. It's the fact that there's going to be such a demand on these underground resources, and that's upon us. And one thing that Tom has not mentioned is the amount of litigation that begins to happen when your well goes dry and you sue somebody and draw the department in and demand that they regulate. So in an odd sort of a way, this is either we can pay to try to get the research done or we can pay to litigate. And so I'd rather have the research done and then work forward in a more formal way to try to stop people from drilling wells by saying to them, hey, the water's not there. Don't drill the well, because then you're going to be in a lawsuit and then we're going to have to pay to fight our way through it. It'd be better if we had an understanding, first of all, of whether they can or can't drill. And that's not, we don't have that understanding for all those areas that you see. So for those reasons, Mr. Chair, we would at least place this concept before you, and then the committee, of course, can do with it as it will. Both ideas take money, and in large part, I wanted to bring this to you so that the borderline desperate situation that we are in was on your table, because, or our table here at the legislature. Because when I drive back across the state and see well drilling rigs every 50 miles or so, you know we're going to have a problem. And we already do have it, actually. So it's an attempt here to get out ahead of it as best we can.
Mr. Chair.
Yeah.
Me here first. Okay. I've got a couple questions.
Representative Gillian.
Thank you, Representative Pence. Just to go back to my earlier question, the bill does take into account these orange areas as needed study, or are we talking about an emphasis on new studies outside those three basins?
So, Mr. Chair, President Gilliam, the bill simply says that the department is to go study the situation, and the least they can do is look at the areas that haven't already been studied. They may well come back and say, hey, the areas that we've already studied we're satisfied with, or maybe we need more work. I know the millions that were spent in the Deschutes, and I'm still not sure that we know exactly what's going on. At least we have a much better idea. But it's a time and money intensive process. So the department wouldn't just go crazy. They would look at the budget, look at the area of need, and then proceed.
Mr. Chair, I'd just like to make a comment if I could. And I appreciate that. And you know, we've talked about both our regions. You know how concerned I am, just like everybody else is at this table, about this. I will say this. I understand that there'll be limited, if we pass a bill like this, there's limited funds. And then we have to hook up with our federal partners to make sure that it actually happens. But here's my point. As depressing as that is for all of us, I appreciate the information. We're all worried. Here's what I find good about this, and this is from my experience with farmers in my district who are desperate for more water. A policy that continues to just hold a gun to the head of farmers to find water is the wrong policy. We all know there's a shortage of water. My farmers can't create water, neither can your department or the other departments. But even a small step of more information and more assistance beats the heck out of purposely, or even if it's inadvertent, p- pitting farmers against farmers looking for water. And so, to me, we should pass this bill. It ain't going to solve our water problem, but it's a step in the right direction in terms of what the state can do to move toward solutions and not simply put a gun to a farmer's head and say, you go find it or we're going to cut off your water supply. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Chair Clem, Representative Gillum, you folks, I think, are aware of the integrated water resource strategy that our commission passed. There's been a lot of talk here about that. Groundwater information is one of the key elements of that strategy as we move forward. And the state of Oregon is trying to move away from a reactive and pitting farmer against farmer, if you will, more to identifying what are the needs and how are we going to meet those needs, whether it be for storage. The one slide shows our natural storage snowpack and how this year we just don't have it. And that has been an ongoing trend. So we are going to have to look for ways to adjust for that loss of snowpack. Otherwise, we're going to have even a harder time during summer.
Vice Chair Post.
Thank you, Chair Clem. You stole my thunder, Representative Gilliam. You're right on. Representative Bentz, thank you. I know a lot of people on this side of the mountains probably aren't as aware of the situations over there. And seeing this now makes me, I had no idea it was that bad over on this side. You know, I know about the East. I once drilled a well over there that I think I hit T before I hit water. I went so deep. So I know how bad it is. And that was 10 years ago. So I want to thank you that, as he said, the information is invaluable. The bill itself, this is for, Representative Gomberg's not here, but Representative Gomberg and I have a thing about asking why the emergency clause. This is the first one that's come before me. I went, that's why. This truly is an emergency. And I don't think all of Oregon recognizes the dire straits that we're in. And so I appreciate, as he said, if we can at least get the information, that would sure be swell. Thank you.
Vice Chair Helm.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Bentz, for bringing this bill. And this is a good chance to get me a little caught up on some of my memories of water law. And so to do that, remind me of the definition of an exempt well, which is, I believe, referenced in the bill. Is my memory correct that an exempt domestic well allows the owner 15,000 gallons a day of usage?
Chair Clem, Representative Helm, in Oregon statute, I'll call them smaller uses, are called out specifically in statute as those uses not requiring a water right permit, the exempt uses. And you're right, for single family domestic or group domestic, you can use up to 15,000 gallons per day without the need of a water right permit. You're also allowed to irrigate up to 1/2 acre non-commercial lawn and garden. So generally speaking, that's not part of the 15,000. That's a separate piece. But a single family, that will cover their lawn, garden, also their house use. Stock water is also an exemption, and there are a couple other exemptions, well, industrial or commercial, up to 5,000.
Follow up.
So related to that, we do have groundwater critical areas in my backyard, literally up on Parrot Mountain near my district and over on the Clackamas. How would this program interact with groundwater critical areas? Would you need to also be located in an identified groundwater critical area before you could obtain a loan, or was there any is there any connection, or should there be any?
Okay. Chair Clem, Representative Helm, I don't know that the bill limits, other than there is a definition for, is it lower income? There's that provision, which follows, I think, its housing definition. Other than that, it is aimed towards domestic wells and if they have to deepen or repair. But I don't see a limitation where if you were in a critical groundwater area, for example, I don't know why you would not qualify.
And if I may, Mr. Chair, the whole idea is driven by the desire in farming areas to allow farmers to continue to access the water that they are pumping, while at the same time allowing those who are living out of the country to keep using their domestic source by deepening the well. Because the whole idea, of course, is to maximize the sustainable volume contained within the aquifer. So that's the idea. It's trying to address both issues, keeping our farmers farming and keeping the people who live in the country still able to take a shower. I must say I'm always amused by the amount of 15,000 gallons a day, because the limiting factor generally is the cost of pumping 200 or 300 feet up, and usually your well is 5 or 10 gallons a minute. I mean, it's a bit of a joke, but
yeah.
That's kind of a sorry joke, to be honest with you. But yes, it was our intent when we crafted the bill was to apply across the board. If it was a pure income test, that was it.
Yeah, follow-up or question?
So if I understood right, if we had been able to get to these domestic well drillers, like my family was 25 years ago outside of Bend, and said, hey, if you drill 10, 20 feet deeper after you hit water, or 10 or 20 feet deeper than your well driller recommends, maybe we wouldn't be having as exacerbated a problem as we're having now. And if that's the case, is there some thought about in this loan program and requirement allowance to get money from the state to deepen a well, is there any thought about adding that extra buffer amount to the depth of a well so that we don't have to re-drill that well and spend state money on it so quickly again in the future if this condition continues?
Chair Clem, Representative Helm, I think that's a good point. Again, the bill, the way it's written, I don't believe that there's any limitation, but that would be something to keep in mind as an applicant would come in for the loan to make sure that their proposed action is sufficient to meet the need over a longer period of time rather than 1 or 2 years. Another action which is not included in the bill is lowering the pump. Maybe the well itself is deep enough, but maybe it would take either a different pump or a lowering of pump, and that may be something that we want to consider as discussions go forward.
Thank you very much.
Any further questions for these two gentlemen? We've got one more witness to testify as well. Okay. With that, thank you for bringing this bill to us.
Thank you.
Peggy?
Peggy Lynch, League of Women Voters of Oregon. Thank you, Representative Vance, for bringing this bill forward. It is critical. It's a wonderful discussion for you all to have. And the League supports groundwater studies. We have been doing so for years and have been frustrated by the lack of the ability of this body to find the funds to do so. We're pleased that there's 300 plus in this budget, but we know that it's not significant, it's not enough. We also served on the Integrated Water Resources Strategy, and we know that data is critical to make any of these decisions related to water. So while we have reservations about this particular bill, and at least at this point, because there's obviously not enough money to do the studies, the statewide study is required in the time allowed, we are certainly pleased to have the conversation coming forward and are searching for solutions, because this is a really, really important issue for the state. Thank you for listening to me.
Representative Gilliam.
Thank you. Peggy, does the League have as good an advocate as you at the federal level to help with the Oregon delegation and the rest of the lovely Congress to focus on this? Because that's where the dough is going to have to come from.
So, Representative Clem, Representative Gilliam, the league has a national league, and our league representatives there do talk about this particular issue amongst others, frankly focusing a great deal on climate change and the effects of climate change, of which this water shortage is one. So thank you for that compliment. And frankly, in talking to Senator Wyden the last time I had an opportunity through a town hall, we certainly brought up the issue of water and wastewater issues, particularly infrastructure funding, that we need to take care of that funding issue.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Until I get Congressman Witt back there, this is the best link I have.
We could ask the league to go over to like a federal mint. No one would suspect them. And they could just basically break in, rob the place, bring all the money back, and no one would think they would be guilty. They're sort of good government do-gooders, and we have them go rob the man. What do you think? Oh, the mic's on. Oh.
Thank you, Chair Clapp.
There goes that plan. Anybody else? Oh. This was Claire Clark.
Yes, Claire Clark from Corbett. At the risk of too much exposure, I've been in the Natural Resources Committee, but this is one of my first jobs. One of my first visits at the Conservation District was a lady that had put in that had a 400-foot well, and it went dry, and they had to get rid of their cattle herd, and they put a 600-foot well in, and they went dry. And when I visited there, they were just about ready to put in another well. And at that time, I suggested rainwater harvesting. I didn't know anything about it. Since then, I've been on the board of the American Rainwater Harvesting or Catchment Association. And now in Clackamas County, we know that there's 5 groundwater restricted areas in the county alone. So we're not talking, and we're talking about population increase, we're talking about production, agriculture increase. We do have conservation. They are putting the irrigation canals in pipes, which is a big help. Impact sprinklers are now going to drip and to low flow sprinklers and those types of things. But one of the things that you might look for, and as far as in the domestic situations and some of the small agriculture, is rainwater harvesting. There's one spot in Clackamas County that has a 309,000 gallon or an acre foot of water that's rainwater harvested. So that is a possibility, because we all know that groundwater comes from precipitation, and that's a factor too. So and as far as the 15,000 gallons a day, in my house, there's 4 people in a family, sometimes 5, and we only use 10,000 gallons a month, and then 20,000 gallons maybe in the summer. So that's a truck. That's a leak you can drive a truck through, or a hole you can drive a truck through in our water law. Anyway, that's it for today, and thank you. Any questions?
Any questions? I've had the bill to lower the daily threshold several times. I gave up on it because I got tired of losing to Mr. Chandler, but he's not here right now, so maybe I could dredge it up again, you know, see what the relating clause is.
Okay.
All right, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Any further items for folks on this bill? Okay, I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 3169, and that appears to be our agenda for the day. Anything else for good of the order? All right, thank you. Close to the committee.
Just said.
Well, let's try it. Okay. We're going to reopen the committee. And we need a motion to suspend the rules for the purposes of allowing Representative McLean to vote.
Mr. Chair,
I have to reopen the work session. So
I'm on it.
Let me reopen the work session for House Bill 3030. And now we need a rule suspension.
Mr. Chair, I move that we suspend the rules for the purposes of voting on House Bill 3030.
Vice Chair Howell moves the Vice Chair moves the rules be suspended for the purposes of allowing Representative McLean to vote on House Bill 3030. Any objection? Hearing none. The rules are suspended. Representative McLean, how do you vote?
Aye.
Representative McLean votes aye. We'll close the work session on House Bill 3030, reopen the work session on House Bill 2734. And I would take a motion for rule suspension here.
Mr. Chair, I move that we suspend the rules for the purpose of allowing Representative McLean to vote on House Bill 2734 as amended.
Vice Chair Helm moves the rules be suspended for the purposes of allowing Representative McLean to vote on House Bill 2734 as amended. Any discussion? No discussion allowed. Any objection? Seeing none, this was to move to Transportation and Economic Development, by the way.
I vote aye.
Representative McLean votes aye. We close the work session on House Bill 2734. Let me adjourn the committee.